Hello. This audio snippet, we're once again planning to continue talking about the grant years and in particular the attempts to annex Santo Domingo, which is now known as the Dominican Republic, and the conflicts that created. And always in the context of Black America and everything going on in the country at the time. But before that, we believe it's important to talk about certain other things that are happening at the time of this recording. So we may not get to talk about Grant for a while. First, I'd like to start by clarifying that in previous audio snippets, we have often talked about the signs of things not going well for the country, and we talk about specific news events and things that clearly show that America is not responding to the truth. But it's always been spoken in the sense that, well, these are bad signs, but we're looking for something that will hopefully show a change in the trend, even though it always seemed very unlikely. But now I've realized, after all that has happened and what we've shared in the last couple of audio snippets, that it is basically very evident that America is going to die in less than 9 months. It's no longer a question of, oh, well, it's looking pretty bad and things are desperate and we need a late game miracle to overcome the score. It's no longer like that. And I'll give you an example of one thing that happened when I was a very young person. I remember I was listening to the Baltimore Orioles playing against the Chicago White Sox, if I'm not mistaken. It was back in 1983. I was a big Orioles fan living in Baltimore. I would listen to their games on the radio every night, faithfully, almost religiously, on WFBR. That was the radio station that broadcast the Orioles games in those days. I don't know if that station exists anymore in Baltimore, but the thing is that I was listening to one game one night, and the score was 4-2 in favor of the Chicago White Sox. They were in Baltimore, and at that time, me and my family used to live not that far away from Memorial Stadium. That's where the Orioles used to play in those days, an old stadium that was, I think, built in 1954. The thing is that I was listening to the game, and it was 4-2. The Chicago White Sox were in Baltimore, and they were leading bottom of the ninth. So it was bottom of the ninth. And the first Oriole came up to bat, and he was out. I forget how, but you know, so there was one out. Then the next Oriole came up to bat, and he was also put out. So it was two outs in the bottom of the ninth, bases empty, and the score 4-2. It just seemed absolutely hopeless. Like there was no hope that the Orioles were going to win that game. But then something lit up in my head. It's like, I don't know how to explain it. It's as if I almost like a voice said, "Do you believe?" And I said, "Yes, I believe." And then I started believing that somehow, out of nowhere, the Orioles were going to win that game. I was a young kid at the time. I was just, you know, barely a teenager. And I said, "I will believe." And then I just started like interceding just with every pitch, just faithfully believing that something was going to happen. And I forget the the minutia of the balls and strikes of everything. But I remember that one, I forget who it was. It may have been Cal Ripken or someone like that. But someone came up to bat, you know, two outs, bottom of the ninth. And somehow he got on base. Either he was walked or got a base hit, but he got on base. And then I kept believing. And then the next batter came up, and he got on base, too. So there were two on, with two out, bottom of the ninth, 4-2. And then another Oriole came up, and he got a base hit. And I think one run came in, 4-3. And then another Oriole came up, and he got a hit, and so forth. And they just kept getting on base, getting on base. They tied the score 4-4, and then I think it was through a base hit. Someone hit a base hit, and someone came around the bases from the Orioles, and they scored, and they won 5-4. And then I knew, yes, the miracles are possible. And from then on, the Orioles took off. I don't remember what month of the year that happened. It might have been July of 1983, or June, late June, early July. But from then on, the Orioles took off, and they started having these miracle victories where they would come from behind in the bottom of the ninth and hit one dramatic home run to win the game, and they just kept doing that over and over and over again. And that was the year they won the American League East Division. Then they played the Chicago White Sox, the team that they had defeated miraculously that night, in the playoffs, and they defeated the White Sox and went on to the World Series and played the Philadelphia Phillies. They lost the first game in Baltimore. I think it was 1-0. And then they swept the Phillies in four games after that. And they won the last game in Philadelphia on a very cloudy day. I remember when I was watching it on television. And that was the last time the Orioles ever won a World Series or ever won anything, you know, that big. But the reason why I'm telling you this is I've seen miracles. I remember one time I was watching listening again to a football game, American football game on the radio. I'm sorry, I was watching it on television. I apologize. I was watching it on television, and it was the Miami Hurricanes against the Maryland Terrapins. It was a college football game. American football game between universities. And I was a Maryland Terrapin fan, follower to the core of the Terrapins in those days. And, you know, being in Baltimore, which is in the state of Maryland, I was a follower of the University of Maryland Terrapins. And they were playing the Miami Hurricanes, who were at that time one of the top universities, you know, football teams in the country. Maryland was kind of up and coming in those days. And they were playing in Miami on a cloudy day, I remember again. And Miami was expected to win comfortably. But I was hoping maybe Maryland was going to, you know, play a good game and somehow pull an upset or something like to that effect. As I was watching the game, and the Miami Hurricanes were running all over the Terrapins, and they were scoring and scoring. And when it came to halftime, the score was 31-0 in favor of Maryland. And I said to myself, okay, I'm going to turn off the TV. This is just too embarrassing, too depressing. And I was a kid at the time. This must have been 1984, maybe 84. I was about to turn off the television, and then I heard once again that voice say, "Do you believe?" And then it's like as if the voice said, "It's easy to believe when things are easy, but this is hard. Do you still believe?" And I said, yes, I believe. And I started, and I didn't turn off the television. I said, okay, something is going to happen. And I began to intercede on every play, believing that something was going to happen. And the second half started, and they started playing and everything. And then suddenly the score was, Maryland was able to score, and it was 31-7. Then it was 31-14. Then it was 31-21. I don't remember the exact sequence of scores, but more or less that's vaguely what I remember. Then it was 31-28, and then they tied it 31-all. And Miami was able to score a field goal. It was 34-31. Maryland scored. It was 38-34. And then I think the Miami was able to score again, and they missed or tried for a two-point play, but they missed it. So it was 40-34 or something like that. And then Maryland was able to drive towards the end of the game, and they scored. I'm forgetting the exact sequence, but I think it was the score was the final score. They were able to score at the end, and the final score was 42-40, which is a very high scoring game, even by American football standards. And Maryland won the game, and it was a huge upset of a nationally ranked powerhouse team in their stadium. Maryland won 42-40 after being down 31-0 at halftime. And it was at that time, maybe if not the greatest, one of the greatest, biggest comebacks in college football history. And it was against a minor team. It was one of the best teams in the country. Miami had actually been the national champions 2 years before, if I'm not mistaken, 2 or 3 years prior. So they were definitely one of the best teams in the country, and Maryland was not that well known at the time as a football team. And the reason why I'm telling you this is I saw that victory from 31-0 and winning at the end 42-40. I believe that was the final score. And so I know miracles can happen. I know that incredible comebacks can happen. So what I'm about to tell you is not from the context of someone who doesn't believe that great things can be achieved even against a great odds. My whole life, I've seen it over and over again, even in my personal life, mercifully. So what I'm about to say is from the context of that, just take that into account, that I see what's going on and I don't see any hope. And it's no longer a matter of believing, that it can supernaturally happen, because this is no longer a matter that can be controlled by anyone from the outside, because it's a matter of the will of the people. People don't want to change, and you can hope and believe all you want for them, but at the end, they have the free will to decide what will and will not happen. So this is not up to us. See, in those games that I was telling you about, there were players there who were I believe many of them were openly open or explicitly open in their hearts and minds to being influenced by a power that would propel them to victory. They were open to it. Even if they were not consciously aware of it, they were open to it. And I can tell you, and it'll be very long to explain why I know that. But I know that from from things that happened afterwards that I found out later, but that's too long to explain right now. The thing is that these players were open to being influenced by something that would propel them to victory. But the people in this country are not open to that. We don't have the players who are open to the truth, to be influenced so that supernaturally we can achieve the victory that is needed. It's not there. It's not there. So the country is dead. It's not officially dead, I believe. It will be dead in less than 9 months. And there's a date after which, when we cross that date, there is no hope. It's like we have the patient is in a coma, it's lying in bed, it's not responding, it's not doing anything, and it's just a matter of waiting for it to die. We've been waiting and waiting for it to wake up, and there are no signs. And every time there's a bit of sign of hope, it's always countered by a completely opposite sign of no hope. And so it's just, and the body's almost beginning to rot, even as it's alive. There is no hope. And every time we feed hope into that body, it seems to, instead of bringing it to life, it seems to strengthen the organisms inside the body that are killing it. Because it's as if by giving this country hope, we're basically saying to the conservatives, to the people out there, that yes, this is a country that can be fought for and can be saved. And when they hear that, what they believe is, yes, the country of our founding fathers, the country of our great and holy constitution, that country can be restored. We are not off because our founding was so wonderful that, yes, we can recover from this because we are a great country founded by great principles. So they start, getting strengthened and saying, yes, we will be able to go back to the good old days, instead of realizing, no, the reason why we're in this is because of the good old days, that the foundation left so many, we've gone through this over and over again, so many gaping holes that have led to what we have right now. And we need to change the foundation and recognize that we need to start a new nation with a new foundation of principles. And a new understanding of the truth, and they don't want to do that. So every time we send out hope for them, we're just feeding them, and then they turn around and attack the very people who gave them hope, who enabled them to have hope. So it's not worth giving them hope anymore. The country is on its way to dying, and there's no longer any hope. Now let's, I don't know if that's going to create some sort of reaction when they realize there is no hope, then suddenly they will wake up. But I'm not waiting for that. Forget about it. The country's gone. So from now on, as we share these things, these audio snippets, we're not going to do it in the context of hoping to have somebody hear something and wake up and start this critical mass of transformation. And by critical mass, I mean there has to be a certain number of people who wake up for the country to change. Because a few people can wake up here and there. But if we don't reach that critical mass, we don't have the nuclear reaction that will lead to the transformation that we need. So we're not going to speak in that context anymore of talking as if we were trying to revive the coma guy. The coma guy is lying there. He's going to die. So we're just speaking as people just narrating the death of a nation. I don't know why it needs to be done, but it needs to be done. Maybe as a declaration and a sentence and an indictment, eternal indictment on this country, because no one else is indicting it for what it needs to be indicted for. There's a reason why this country is dying and will be dead, and very few people are declaring the exact reasons why it's dying. And some people are getting close to it, but they are not quite saying it, so I guess these audio snippets are part of that. It's almost as the declaration of why this country is dying and the judgment and the sentencing of this nation. So that's the context from which we will be speaking. And it's really kind of it relieves a burden, at least from my heart and mind, even though my heart sank into great sadness as I became aware of this. It is a bit of a relief, no longer waiting for fantastic restoration something that will never live again. So before we talk about that, I'll say something that seems to be contradicting everything I just said, but I hope you see that it doesn't. I do need to mention something I had not mentioned before, that when we were talking about the World Cup and all the sad things, the consequences of that final game, my heart sank, and that was the beginning of the awareness. Things are not going to change. That very next week in America, suddenly, that very next week, we had this sudden week of just massively cold weather that just hit the entire country, almost the entire country, something I had never seen in my lifetime. From west all the way to the east, this cold front that swept on down all the way to the south, and all the whole country became cold, and there were snowstorms and all these horrible things that happened throughout the country, and it reached even from south and went up back up towards the north and hit the northeast. Upstate New York got really pounded severely with bad weather and a whole bunch of stuff. In Buffalo, New York, people died, and all these things, terrible things happened. And but thankfully, the New York area was spared. So we had some kind of bad weather and all that. There was one day when the temperature went down from 50 degrees Fahrenheit, I remember that afternoon, down to 30 degrees in just a couple of hours. It's like 20 degrees Fahrenheit, which is, I think, like 10 or 11 degrees centigrade, in 2 hours. Boom! I could feel, and then a gust of wind, it was just bitter cold, just came, but thankfully there was no snow and more complications like the rest of the country. So, in mercy to me, I guess, that's how I see it. We were spared in this part of the country, but it says, and the explanation that the weather people gave is that it's this low pressure, incredibly low pressure system came. It was like a vacuum. And then that, you know, nature, as they always say, abhors a vacuum. And that would cause a lot of things to swirl into that vacuum. And that created this whole complication of weather. I'm not a meteorologist, so I may be saying this in a very bungled way, but it was a low pressure front that exposed a vacuum, and the vacuum began to get filled with bad stuff, you know, and that's a figure of the country, and it was as if that low pressure was almost symbolic of the sinking of my heart, the depression that I fell into, and when I realized it's all over. And that was the same week that there was this magnetosphere event that we talked about in the previous audio snippet, where the sun hit the Earth's magnetosphere and opened a big hole, and it was a very unusual event. It's as if all of this was confirming that something very bad had happened that week. But now let me share something that happened recently this week. The name of there was a football player who plays for the Buffalo Bills, and it's interesting now that I think about it. I had not thought about this, but you know that quarterback who that Maryland game against Miami that I was just telling you about back in 1984, I think it was. And you can look it up if you don't believe me. You can maybe online you can find that game where the Maryland Terrapins went from 31-0 to win 42-40, and it was a gray, depressing afternoon. I remember both in Baltimore and in Miami, so it was in this very depressing environment that this incredible thing happened. But the thing is that the quarterback for the Maryland Terrapins that day, his name happened to be Frank Reich. And that guy went on to make it to the professional ranks, you know, the National Football League, and he played for the Buffalo Bills. And there was a playoff game, I think, in 93 I don't remember the exact year, but it was in the early 90s where the Buffalo Bills were playing the Houston Oilers. I mean, that's how long ago it was when Houston had a team called the Oilers that then moved to Nashville and became the Tennessee Titans later on. But at that time, there were the Houston Oilers, and they were being quarterbacked by Warren Moon, a black quarterback in those days, unusual thing in those days. He was one of the best quarterbacks of all time, but didn't really get much success. That's another story. The thing is that Warren Moon and the Houston Oilers were playing in Buffalo, and at halftime, I forget the score, but it was a huge margin of it in favor of Houston. I may be exaggerating. I think it was 35-3, something like that. It was a 32 point lead that Houston had over Buffalo, and for all intents and purposes, Houston had won the game. And I thought Houston was winning because I was rooting for Houston at that time, because I liked Warren Moon. But then Frank Reich, who was playing for the Bills, I don't know if he came on or he replaced the quarterback or the starting quarterback, Jim Kelly, I think it was injured or something. But somehow Frank Reich got into the game playing for the Buffalo Bills in the second half. And I don't know if he started the game. I don't remember. But the thing is, in the second half, Frank Reich was the quarterback of the Buffalo Bills. They were down by 32 points or something to that effect. And then they started scoring and scoring and scoring and scoring and scoring. And lo and behold, they ended up winning the game, maybe 38-35. I forget. They came from behind, just like the Maryland Terrapins had done in 1984. The same quarterback, almost 9 years later. It's as if the impartation that he had received that day, that gray day in Miami, was on him. And as a professional, he did it again with the Buffalo Bills against the Houston Oilers. And they went on to, I think they made it to the Super Bowl that year, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong. And if they did, they lost it, because Buffalo has never won the Super Bowl. Every time they reached the Super Bowl, they always lost it. So there's the connection there to Buffalo. And Buffalo at the end, even though they had that great comeback that day, they eventually lost the Super Bowl. So in a sense, it was for naught, in the sense that they did continue in the playoffs, but they didn't achieve the desired Super Bowl victory at the end. Well, speaking of the Buffalo Bills, there was a player for Buffalo this week. His name is Damar Hamlin, and that's very significant. And this is why I'm talking about this. There was a play. I don't watch football, American football anymore, so I just found out because this was big news. There was this play where he's a defender for the Buffalo Bills, and I think they were playing the Cincinnati Bengals, and that has a lot of significance too, but that's another story. The thing is that the Bengals threw a pass or something, and this defender for the Buffalo Bills, a black young player called Damar Hamlin, went and tackled the Cincinnati defender. And it was it was not a hard hit. It was just a normal play. I saw the clip, and there was nothing special about the play in the sense of being very violent or anything like that. It was normal. It was almost a very soft tackle, but he tackled the guy, and then he went, he was on the ground at the end of the tackle, like a normal tackle, and he got up, and the Cincinnati player got up, and he started walking away. And then suddenly, his hands went I don't know if you've ever seen Lost in Space, that robot in that old television show, Lost in Space, that had his hands, and when he would go, danger, Mr. Robinson, danger, that's how his hands kind of came up. And he just dropped almost like dead to the ground. On his back, and turned out he was having a heart attack in the middle of the game. They interrupted the whole game, and they ended up taking him to the hospital after 9-10 minutes trying to resuscitate him on the field. Everybody was just astonished, And to the point that, if I'm not mistaken, because I don't follow football anymore, but I believe the game was suspended. And this is the first time I've ever heard, you know, in all my life, that a football game was suspended because of an injury or something that happened on the field. Because people have been paralyzed on the field, and they take them off the field, and the people cheer and all that, but the game always continues. This time it was so different, and there was even a commentator who spoke about that, how strange it is that they have suspended the game and done all this pause of the game to this extent. And he got a lot of criticism for that, but as if he was insensitive, but he was not being insensitive. He was just pointing out a fact. There was something very weird about this. And when you look at him, he looks just like the people who have these sudden heart attacks because of the mRNA injection. And a 24-year-old kid, and apparently he's a very devout Christian, a very, he's not like, the other professional athletes who are just, arrogant and thuggish and all that. He seems like a very nice young man, from what I've heard, a very devout Christian and does a lot of charity work and very, very sensitive, caring person and blah, blah, blah. But the thing is that, people thought he was dead because, you know, many people suspected he had not had oxygen to his brain for 9 minutes. So he was almost, many people thought he was brain dead. And yes, it was confirmed he had a myocarditis event or something. So it was related to his heart. And no one has said it out loud except for the people who know about this, you know, who have admitted it in their hearts. But the people who haven't been willing to admit the danger of the mRNA gene therapy injections, they just keep pretending like this has nothing to do with anything. And some people have even said the violence of football, and we have to stop the violence of this violent game and blah, blah, blah. When in fact, the hit had nothing to do with him. He just fell. He got up. He was able to walk. And then as he was walking away from the tackle, that's when he fell to the ground. So it wasn't the hit at all. And I think what happened is during the play, somehow a blood clot must have gotten loose, you know, and then the blood clot went to his heart and boom, that's when the thing happened. That's so football per se had nothing to do with it. It was just a ticking time bomb. And he was out for quite a while and people were praying for him. And even on ESPN, sports cable network, there was one guy who stopped his show in the middle of the show to pray. And he said, I know this is not, I know I may get in trouble for doing this, but he just said, I am going to pray. And he prayed for the guy. So there was this total concern for him. And then apparently either yesterday or today, I forget when it was, that the guy woke up. And everybody considers it a miracle that he woke up and he was conscious. He was not like brain, he didn't suffer any sort of brain retardation, apparently. He was asking who won the game and everything. So it looks like a miracle. The guy came back to life and you say, oh, well, isn't that a sign of hope? No, it isn't. And I'll tell you why. First of all, The kid being a Christian and all that, you would think that the guy would be disconnected from following, you know, trends and things like that. But he clearly took the injection. And you don't have to take the injection if you play in the NFL. They hate you if you don't, and they will make you pay with constant tests and all that. But I think it's not required, it's not mandated, because I know of certain players who have refused to take the injection and are still playing. So he didn't try to be contentious. He said, I'm going to be the nice Christian who, you know, follows, who submits to authority and follows the rules and does the right thing in the sense of obeying superiors and this and that. And he took the injection. clearly he took the injection, and we see the consequences. So in that sense, he seems like a very nice fellow, but I don't empathize with him, if you know what I'm saying. And I don't know if now that he has gone through that, he has had any awareness of how stupid he was for taking the injection and trying to be non-confrontational and non-conflictive. I don't know. And I don't think he's going to have that moment, that epiphany. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. If I suddenly hear that he's now speaking out against the injections, then I don't know. Maybe that will start worrying me that maybe the country will come back to life, because I don't want to get into that again. You see what I'm saying? I don't want to feed the body hope anymore. But I don't think that moment is going to come. So I don't have any empathy for him. It's like he chose his own. He picked his poison, literally. He made his bed and now he's lying in it, literally. In the hospital. He plays for the Buffalo Bills, a team that was never able to get over the hump. They went to the Super Bowl 4 times. And I believe one of those 4 times was during that comeback that I was telling you about was during that 4 Super Bowl run that they had, the Buffalo Bills, but they were never able to make it, to win the big game, to get over the hump. And I believe that's a symbol of America. So yes, there might be signs of an apparent awakening, apparent revival, like this guy who suddenly, miraculously, shall we say, came back to life after the injection induced heart attack on the field. But it's never going to be enough to get over the hump. And he's a symbol of the people who are not willing to fight, who are not willing to question the fundamental things, because they just want things to be okay. And that's a lot of conservatives, even though they seem contrarian because they are fighting, against the liberal onslaught that's going on, a lot of them suffer from that same thing because they grew up in conservative homes where traditional values and going to church and all this traditional stuff has been part of their lives, and they have never wanted to contradict their own family, contradict the same belief system that they have grown up in, So they are, in the same sense, like this Damar Hamlet. They don't want to confront the authority figures that they have grown up admiring their whole lives. And those authority figures include, at a higher level, the Founding Fathers, the Constitution, and all this stuff. And they're unwilling to rebel against it. And it's not rebellion for the sake of rebellion. It's rebellion because you're listening to the truth. The truth is more important than anything else. More important than your family. More important than anything. The truth is the center of everything. That is what we must follow. The truth. And these people would rather follow and submit to the values they have lived under all their lives, then follow the truth to the end. They may follow it to a certain point, but they never cross the Jordan to make it to where they need to go. And so now this guy, it kind of drew my attention. His name is very peculiar. Damar Hamlin, both his first name and his surname are very peculiar. And Hamlin, if you've been listening to these audio snippets, is not a coincidence, because Hamlin happens to be the name of the fellow that we have talked about a great deal. In some audio snippets, his name is Hannibal Hamlin. And as you may recall, he was Abraham Lincoln's vice president during his first term. He was a man from Maine, the state of Maine, and he was a staunch anti-slavery guy. And he was Lincoln's vice president. And Lincoln, who was so hell-bent on reuniting the country at all costs, isolated Hamlin and really never had any connection with him during his whole first term. He kind of isolated him, ostracized him, because Hamlin was an anti-slavery abolitionist. And he didn't want to be hearing from a guy who was going to feed him the message of you have to strike the South and defeat the South and wipe out slavery, because he wanted to reunify the country, even if slavery was to be kept. That was his whole intent. We've talked about this, how the son of a bitch Lincoln did so much damage to the country. And that worthless little bastard is always praised and exalted by everybody, when he is one of the most shameful characters in American history. At the end of the day, he could have done so much. He could have transformed this country. He could have done so many things, and he was a coward, or maybe not a coward. He was just not interested. It was not cowardice. It was just, he just didn't care enough to do it, because he wanted to be loved. At the end of the day, he wanted to be loved by the South, by everybody. And he ostracized Hannibal Hamlin, and when his second term option came up, he said, Hamlin is, I don't want him anymore, and he went and sided with Andrew Johnson, and he accepted Andrew Johnson as his vice presidential candidate for his second term. And we all know what happened. We've talked about this in these audio snippets. Andrew Johnson was a Northerner. He was born in Ohio, maybe somewhere in the North, I think. But he was a Southerner at heart. He became a Tennessean at the end. He went and died in Tennessee. I mean, he was, for all intents and purposes, a Southerner, a Tennessee Southerner. And he was in favor of slavery when the son of a bitch Lincoln got deservedly shot in the head and kind of sent away as a worthless bastard into the trash heap of history. Then Andrew Johnson took over as president, and he blockaded every effort to truly free black people in the South. And why? Because the stupid Lincoln put him in the position to be president after he was killed. And Andrew Johnson, I believe, is burning in hell, the son of a bitch. So Andrew Johnson was there because Hannibal Hamlin was rejected. And Hannibal Hamlin represents the greatest president that never was. Because if Hamlin had been there as vice president when Lincoln died, American history would have been so completely different. Hannibal Hamlin as the president of the United States, the 17th president, instead of the son of a bitch Andrew Johnson, would have made such a difference in helping free black people in the South. It would have changed American history altogether. We'd be a different country altogether. So it's interesting that this young black guy, has a surname of Hamlin, which is associated to this man who was anti-slavery and could have transformed American history if the idiot Lincoln had allowed him. And I consider Hannibal Hamlin one of the 10 greatest Americans of all time. Unknown as he is, I believe, one of the 10 greatest Americans of all time. And he lived to a ripe old age. Like, he lived into the 1890s. I think he was the oldest vice president or former vice president in American history. He lived that long. He outlived a whole bunch of presidents and a whole bunch of people. He outlived Lincoln and a whole bunch of people. It's as if he was being allowed to live to show that, you know, how fruitful he would have been had he been allowed to be president. But the thing is that this young guy's name, first name Damar, is kind of peculiar. I've never heard in my life anyone called Damar. So I kind of looked up his name, and there are some kind of conflicting interpretations of what that name means or where it comes from. I saw one online thing that said, oh, it comes from Italian, meaning of the sea. You know, like mar. Like mar, I think, means sea in many languages. So maybe that's where they got that. Of the sea, Damar, and some other, another website said it comes from Javanese, not Japanese, but Javanese, you know, from the island of Java. And it means light. But this is the one that I believe is most directly related to all of this. Others said that it comes from Old Greek, and it's a variation of the name Damaris, which is mostly, and this is where the relevance comes in, it's mostly a female name. Damaris is mostly a female name. Apparently it's used every now and then by males, Damar, a variation of it. But the name is mostly for baby girls, and Damaris appears in the Bible actually. And I found this online. It says in Acts 17:34, there is a woman, I forget, in Corinth or somewhere, that helps Paul, the Apostle Paul, and her name was Damaris, and Damaris apparently comes from the Greek verb damazo, which means to tame, to curb, to restrain. And this is the essence of what this young man represents, a tame man, a man who's been tamed, who restrains himself, who curbs himself, who tries to avoid conflict and criticism, and tries to just be nice and you know, getting along with people and so forth, you know, and doesn't want to create negativity, you know, quote unquote negativity, who's tame, who's been, so Damar Hamlin actually means the taming of Hamlin. In other words, the taming of someone who will create strife and conflict. That's why Lincoln didn't want Hamlin. He wanted Johnson because Andrew Johnson was a Southerner at heart. And he said, oh, if I have Andrew Johnson as my running mate, the South is going to see, that was 1864, the war was still going on. The South is going to see that I am willing to reconcile with you, with all y'all. And see, I have a Democrat. Andrew Johnson was not even a Republican. He was a Democrat. So he was saying to the Democrats and to the South, hey, I'm willing to sleep with the enemy, with you guys. I'm willing to fornicate with you. That's just to show you that I don't want to fight you anymore. So Andrew Johnson represented reconciliation, represented getting along and not fighting anymore. And Hamlin represented conflict. You know, this thing that slavery has to end, and free people, black people have to be treated with respect and dignity. And the South didn't, you know, and that was conflictive. And so Damar Hamlin means the taming of Hamlin. So that's why he represents all these stupid Christians in America who just believe and just, oh, I'm just going to focus on God, and I'm not going to worry about politics or anything like that, because all of that is conflictive, and I only care about God and the spiritual stuff. When they don't realize everything, if their religion is true, then everything is, shouldn't God be in everything, don't you think? If you believe in God, don't you think that he should be in everything? He manifests himself in every sphere of human activity. If you believe it, you stupid Christian, if you believe in your God, do you want him? Do you believe that he's restricted to the walls of your church? He's only relevant in Christian religious things. That's the only place where God is relevant. Everything else is not relevant. I don't care about it. Really, are you that stupid? And yes, I don't want to be in conflict and looking like I am aggressive and this and that, because, you know, Christianity, the American Christianity, as we've said before, is very matriarchal, so very effeminate. And that's part of the reason why this country is on its way to dying, because the Christian, the American Christian, is a tame little bastard, a worthless, useless tool of status quo. Therefore, even though I think this Damar Hamlin seems like a very nice young man and everything, and, you know, it's, yeah, it's commendable that he's doing all this charity work and all this other stuff. It's so wonderful. But, you know, there are enough people doing charity work out there, but there were a few people speaking truth to power, saying the things that need to be said. Is this Damar Hamlet at any point going to confront black people for the problems in the black culture? I don't think so. Is he ever going to confront the NFL and others for promoting the injection that led to his heart attack that almost killed him? I don't think so. Is this young man ever going to speak out against all the evil that's going on with, or is he ever going to say, we need to change the Constitution, we need to change the system, the country that's the country's living under, so that we can survive? No, he's not going to do any of that. He's just going to be a nice guy, he's going to be popular and loved by everybody, and he's not going to make a difference at all at the end of the day. Because if you're feeding people, or you can give a piece of bread to someone, and yes, they're going to eat it, and that's going to be the end of it. But if they are destroying their own lives, they're going to have to be coming back every day to you so that you can give them bread again. You have to break the cycle of their dependence on you for bread. And so you can be in all these soup kitchens and doing all this wonderful work, but if you're not getting to the root of why all these people are in this soup kitchen, then you're really, your life really hasn't done anything. It's like trying to, it's like there's an ocean and you're trying to go there and dip a bucket into the ocean, and you want to empty the ocean one bucket at a time. It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. Oh yeah, I'm making a difference. No, you're not. Yes, you are, but no, you're not. At the end, you're not, because you're just taking one bucket out of an ocean. We have to dry the ocean. We have to get to the root of it. And if we got to the root of it, then there'd be no need to go take a bucket to the ocean every day. And people don't these people don't understand that. They're living in this world of naivete, especially the stupid American Christians. So now that I've said this, so this guy coming back to life is not a sign of hope. It's not a sign of anything. It's just a confirmation, further confirmation. This country's on its way to hell. Another thing that I want to mention that is related to this, it may not seem like it, is a recent story that's been going on about this vote for Speaker of the House in the U.S., House of Representatives. And there's this very evil guy, a piece of dirt, son of a bitch, worthless bastard. That guy's gonna burn in hell the day he dies, straight to hell. His name is Kevin McCarthy. Now, he may not be as evil, quote unquote, as, you know, Bite Me or all the or Nancy Stretch Pelosi and all these other whores, but he's evil in a different way. In a more subtle way, and that's what makes him so dangerous. He was trying to be the Speaker of the House. He was a minority leader up until now, because you know the Democrats had control of the House, so they had the Speaker, the whore Pelosi, and now that they lost control of the House, the Republicans want to have their Speaker. And Kevin McCarthy, having been the minority leader or whip or whatever it's called, he wanted to be the Speaker. So he was nominated. Only two were nominated, apparently. I don't know how that works internally, so I could be a little wrong on some of the details. But from what I understand, only two people were nominated. This son of a bitch, Kevin McCarthy, and some bastard Democrat named Jeffries. And the two were put up to vote, and they needed to have, like, I don't know why, but the magical number they kept mentioning was 216. They needed to get 216 votes to win, but they and Kevin McCarthy, being the Republican, was expected to get the 216 votes easily from his Republican colleagues, but he never kept getting 216, and they kept adjourning and coming back the next day and voting again, and he would always come back short. And it turns out there were 20 Republicans who were holding out and saying, we're not going to vote for that guy, and for good reason, because he's a rhino, he's a traitor, He works with the system, and he once and again is shown how cowardly he is. He doesn't stand up for anything. All he cares for is his political convenience. That's all he cares about, and he's a party tool, a member of the party machinery. That's all he is. He's not a person of conviction. He's a very disgusting human being. So they kept re-voting, and he kept never kept getting elected. And then today, or at least a few hours from the time of this recording, I found out actually, like, shortly before starting this recording, that I saw the headline that finally, on the 11th vote, he was voted in, and everybody was happy. At least the establishment people were all happy. And it's so weird that it happened on the second anniversary of the January 6th incident. You know, January 6th, 2021, I'm sorry, the thing that happened in Washington and the Capitol building, and you know the story. On the second anniversary of that, that's when this son of a bitch, on the 11th vote, got, or maybe it was more than 11 votes, I forget, 14, I don't remember, to be frank, and I don't really care too much, to be very honest about those details, but after a whole bunch of votes, it was at least 11 votes, he got elected on the second anniversary of the January 6th incident. This is the most time, and I saw this headline the other day, I think it was after 11 votes, this is the most votes for speaker that they've had to do, voting counts that they've had to do since 1859. And that's very relevant, and we'll talk about that maybe not now, but later. It's not a coincidence that that year came up in the headline, 1859. It's all connected. And interestingly, in 1859, they had to try 44 times before they elected the Speaker of the House. We talk about, people may say, oh, voting 11 times and all that is over the top, it's a clown show. Well, in 1859, they had to vote 44 times until they decided who the Speaker was. And before then, the most number of votes was 4 years earlier, in 1855. You know how many times they had to vote until they got a speaker? 133 times. And before then, in 1849, they had to vote 63 times. But ever since 1859, there had never been this much controversy on the speaker. And the thing is that the Republican establishment got really upset because they said, oh, you stupid Republicans who are holding out, you're going to get the Democrat elected as Speaker of the House, and you're going to ruin everything. You're insurrectionists, and you're causing trouble and dissent. But the reason why these people were holding out, the 20 Republicans led by Matt Gaetz, a man named Matt Gaetz, is because they wanted to stop the machinery, because they know Kevin McCarthy is going to be betraying and backstabbing, you know, conservatives and the and people who are not Democrats over and over again, and so even Newt Gingrich, which was to me even more confirmation this country's dead. Newt Gingrich was railing against the people who were preventing Kevin McCarthy getting the votes he needed, and that's sad because Newt Gingrich is probably one of the brightest political thinkers in America, of the ones that are living. He was the one who led the 1994 Contract with America revolution that led to the balanced budgets that we had. The years of economic prosperity that we had in the 90s were because of Newt Gingrich and the Republicans of his time, who forced Clinton to have a balanced budget and to do welfare reform, and it just led to this boom of the economy. Because the Republicans, and Clinton was willing to work with the Republicans, admitted that was willing to recognize in his mind that these guys were not idiots, that these guys had brilliant ideas. And that concept of the contract with America was brilliant, because that's part of what is needed, what would have gone in the new American Constitution, the system where a political candidate has to make a contract and in writing and say, I am going to do this, this, and that, and put it in writing. And they're gonna, and there will be penalties, even criminal penalties, if he does not, he or she does not fulfill the contract. So in other words, a system where you don't just make promises willy-nilly, you have to put them in writing, and you're going to say, hey, I'm going to vote, and this is the list of my promises. This is my contract with you. And we talked about this before in some audio snippets, that if for some reason the contract has to be broken, a promise has to be broken because of some extenuating circumstance, then it has to be put up to vote the American people through a voting system that can be established, that can make it very easy to do now with the technology that we have, for the American people who elected him from his state or whatever, to say, hey, we allow you to break this promise. And if they kind of free him from his promise, then he can go ahead and break the promise because the American people have allowed him to. You know, that's the sort of system that we would have gone towards if America had listened to the truth. So the thing is, Newt Gingrich is a very brilliant man, very brilliant thinker. He would have been a great president if he had made it to the White House. But even he now is a part of the machinery, a part of the system. So there are no thinkers in this country, no deep thinkers who are thinking ahead and seeing things in a deeper way. Even the deeper thinkers are dead. So that's a sign that the country is dead. And the anger was, these people are causing conflict. They are stirring the pot. They are, instead of just following the system and just continuing with things the way they are, instead of being Damar Hamlins, these people are fighting. Instead of taming Hamlin, we are letting Hamlin run loose. And unfortunately, eventually the machinery won out, and the son of a bitch McCarthy got his 216 votes. And just to give you an idea what kind of a man that son of a bitch is, I read a story a few hours ago that was talking about a report on the Washington Post talking about McCarthy. And you may say the Washington Post is not a reliable source, but I can tell you this. Everything I read there is consistent with what I've seen firsthand from this McCarthy fellow. So I'm going to read some of what I saw there. It says, a GOP operative speaking to the paper, the Washington Post, on the condition of anonymity, said that McCarthy is a political animal, and he has a lot of political animals working for him. He's not a guy to be trifled with. It's like they say in the Marine Corps, no better friend, no worse enemy. And they mean it, and they act on it. And this McCarthy and his allies work very hard to sabotage MAGA Republicans, you know, Republicans who are sympathetic to Trump. And they worked real hard. McCarthy and his allies worked real hard to take out people like a House representative called Madison Cawthorn. I think he's from North Carolina. I could be wrong. He's from somewhere. He was in the House of Representatives, and he tried to get reelected, and he got and his own Republican Party and the McCarthy people made sure he didn't get elected. And because McCarthy wanted to take out all the Republicans who would be opposed to him in the House. You know, that's the kind of animal he is. He's a worthless son of a bitch. And interestingly, I saw another story before this recording that talked about the House chaplain. There, in the House of Representatives, there's a chaplain who's there to do absolutely nothing, a useless job. This useless chaplain, who in this at this moment is a Presbyterian woman, and I saw a picture of her. She looks kind of lesbianic, you know, with her hair. You know, she, I don't know, there was something off with her. but she's supposedly a priest, a Presbyterian priest, and she's the chaplain of the House of Representatives. So she opened the House session with a prayer, quote-unquote, about, she said, "We're on the verge of a new Congress, oh God." And the person who was writing the article said, "How does she know?" And that was, well, yesterday. Yesterday was when McCarthy got elected. How did she know that we were on the verge of a new Congress? So, or maybe she was prophetic, who knows, but I don't think so. The thing is that she said that, and then she asked God, her God, you know, that an invisible God that she believes in, to end the contentious and unproductive argument. So she was railing against the, she was basically in an kind of a passive-aggressive way, saying to the people in the House there that the people who were opposing the animal McCarthy, you are engaging in unproductive and contentious argument. And when I said, by the way, when I said the thing about invisible God, the God that they believe in doesn't exist. You know, it does exist, but it's more of a demon than the God they claim, he is. That effeminate God of no conflict, that's a figment of their imagination. It doesn't exist. And it contradicts everything they believe in their holy book, the Bible. You read about it. That's not, does it look like the, God is an effeminate, peace loving and kumbaya and let's all get along kind of God, Rodney King, you know, is that the God that appears in their holy book? No, it's a completely different, they have fashioned a God in their head, in their imagination, that is according to their own understanding. What they want him to look like, him or her, because they're not, sometimes they make him into a she, and it's an imaginary animal, and that's what that bitch was praying to, and pardon my French, but that's what she is, a female dog, and she was in a sense, through her so-called prayer, was attacking anyone who dares to confront the current situation. The country's dying, and the bitch is saying, don't fight the destruction. Don't fight the destruction. Play along. Just play along. So this is all correlated to Damar Hamlet, if you see what I'm trying to say. A country that silences opposition. Anyone who questions anything, No, you're no good. In the Christian church, the American Christian church, this constant thing where you don't question authority. Like I was saying about this guy who was talking about the Jehus who are going to rise up in 2023, but the Jehus are going to respect the ecclesiastical authority system. It's almost, he used the word ecclesiastical, it just boggles my mind. The idiot wrote that. Ecclesiastical church system, authority system. When Jehu, as we explained before, was the complete opposite of that. So these people want controlled opposition. You know, that's what they want. Controlled opposition. Who's under an opposition that's under control, that's restrained, that's tame. And that's why this country is dying. And to the point, just so you know, on this last vote on January 6th, it got so contentious that some Republicans were trying to physically attack Matt Gaetz, the guy who is leading the fight to not have McCarthy win. They got so angry because, oh, how dare you? How dare you question the system? And they wanted, because they know that there are political interests tied in. It's all a machinery that we have. And this brings up the bigger thing. As all of this was playing out, you know, I don't care anymore, to be frank. It's like in my head, I don't care because the country's dead. So there's no point in anything. Evil is going to win anyway. That's what the country wants. That's what they'll get. But in the midst of that, I kept saying to myself, will anyone watching all of this begin to ask the bigger question? This is not, this, oh, and by the way, I was reading the comments in an article that said, you know, that mentioned that McCarthy had finally won. And I was finally seeing all these people saying, yes, the country's dead. The country's dead. I have stopped giving up hope, having hope. And even Christians saying, I just don't have any hope for this country anymore. This country is dead. It has rejected God and it's dead. I don't have hope for it anymore. And I say, oh, wow, finally, some people are waking up to the sad reality. But the thing is, but none of them asked the bigger question. You know, what is the big fuss over who the Speaker of the House is going to be? Why is it so important? And that should stir people to a big concern. And why are these political, why was this heavy smear attack on the people who wanted to oppose McCarthy? Why? Why is it so important? Because no one seemed to be asking that question, because the Speaker of the House is someone who's given much political power. And the question should be, why should a Kevin McCarthy, who I think he's from California, I really don't care where he's from, but I think he might be from California. I could be wrong on that. Some obscure guy from California that has never said, I have never heard him say anything of depth. He's not a thinker. He's just an animal, a worthless, obscure animal from California, wherever the hell he's from. Why is he being given so much power? No one voted him, Americans. No American voted for him to have this much power, whatever power the Speaker exercises. So this whole thing was supposed to have brought people to question the whole concept of a Speaker of the House to begin with. And the Speaker of the House is a very powerful animal because he can assign committee chairmanships. You know, all the power clot thing that we have talked about in great detail in previous audio snippets. And this one of the stupid mistakes. You know why they don't question this? Because the Founding Fathers established the Speaker of the House. The idiot Founding Fathers put in this system where they allow one person to have all the control. And they also said the Congress shall define their own rules. And the Speaker of the House is the person who is in control of the rules of legislation. So he can decide, he or she can decide, you know, a lot of things. He can abort legislation through different rules and things. All this arbitrary power placed on this person, and he becomes a power clot. And he's also representative of what's wrong with the party system. It shouldn't be a Republican Party Congress or a Democrat Congress. It should be a Congress of different people, and everyone is individuals, voting as individuals, not as followers of a party machinery behind the scenes, telling them, if you don't vote this way, we're not going to put you as chairman, because we have the Speaker. He's not going to let you be chairman of anything. You're going to be a useless representative with no power, and we're not going to give you money for re-election if you don't toe the line. So this whole party machinery is embedded with the speakership of the House. There should be none of that. People should just go there and vote, and promote individuals promoting organically promoting legislation and the sort. So all of this is a symbol of what's wrong with the country, and no one sees the big picture. Everybody's saying, McCarthy should not be Speaker of the House. The bigger point should have been no one should be Speaker of the House. No one. But no one seems to go there. No one seems to go there. That's why the country is unfortunately dying. And no one seems to be questioning this whole party system. There should be no party controlling anything. No people behind the scenes deciding things. The people who should be deciding things should be the people who were elected by the people to be there to vote. They should be their own individual thinkers promoting ideas and not being beholden to machineries, to people behind the scenes. The whole party system is wrong. And it's why the country is dying. Does anyone want to hear this? No one wants to hear this. because they want to tame Hamlet. They want to tame the Hamlets. They want to Damar the Hamlets. And Damar is a feminine name, a woman's name given to a guy. The effemination of the American spirit. That's what this whole thing has been about, of the male American spirit. And when I'm using the words male and female, I'm not talking about literal male, literal female. I hope you understand what I'm saying. Because as I've said before, Margaret Thatcher was a woman, but she was tough as nails and as male as you can get, as a leader, a powerful leader, a very important leader in her time. I don't think we're going to get to now the meaning of 1859, that number that was mentioned before. And it has to do with... and then we'll go back to the Civil War and talk. So 1859 will take us back to the Civil War and to the things we talked about earlier. And you will see how it all ties in. So even though it doesn't seem like we're talking about Black America or the Civil War anymore, it's all tied in. It's all part of the same thing. I hope you see it. I hope you see the connections of everything. And we're just narrating the death of the nation. That's basically what we're going to be doing from now on. I don't know how long this will continue. How long we'll be recording these audio snippets. And they will go down as an indictment of this nation and a narration of its death. And in less than 9 months, the country will be dead. I no longer see it as a source of sorrow. It's like a source of relief, for crying out loud. It's like having a relative that's never dying, and everybody's been, you know, in this state of, the relative's in a coma, and you know, expensive hospital bills and all this stuff, and the relative is not recovering. It's like a relief. Okay, the relative will finally die in less than 9 months, and then we can decide what to do with our lives after that. And so I've gone from this deep state of hopelessness to a certain sense of relief. I don't have to care about this country anymore. The country doesn't care, because the more I feed it hope with my love and my caring for it, the stronger it becomes, and it becomes strong not to be free from its binds, but to attack the very people who are trying to set her free and destroy the very people who are giving her hope. And there's no reason. I'm not going to fight for you anymore. You know, go to hell. You die. You don't deserve to live anymore, because every time I help you, you start attacking me. Why am I going to help you? Why are we going to help you? America is dead. And we just have to wait it out. And I'll share with you when I see the date come, I will let you know. I know this sounds arrogant of me, but I believe there's a certain date. And that's why I've been saying less than 10 months, because there's a certain date in my head. When we reach that date, I will share it with you. And we will then just declare the country officially dead. Its hopes, everything. This country will become a Hispanic country with a little more money, you know, like Puerto Rico, with a little bit more money than the average Hispanic country, but still bankrupt and full of crime. And we'll see the slow and steady decline of this nation. It will be obvious to people. This is no longer the U.S. It's no longer America. This is Latin America, but with some people who speak English. And it's no coincidence that as all of this is happening, literally hundreds of thousands of Hispanic illegals are coming into the country. And I think that's part of why I see so many Hispanics where I live, like out of nowhere. I see them everywhere. And I think it's also all the illegals that are being dumped into the New York area by the Texas governor and the Florida governor. So instead of sending them to Puerto Rico, as we've said before, doing something more creative, they're sending them to helping them go inland more to get into further into the country, and now they're flooding the country, and this country will become like Latin America, a wasteland of hopelessness, of crime and poverty, of deep pockets of poverty and corruption. It's going to be a very sad end for this country. But I don't care anymore. I really don't. It's not worth caring for. As we've said, giving love to this country is like giving love to a viper. You care for it. You want it to be, you know, it's like these exterminators who that I see on television. There's this guy who sometimes catches a viper that's in somebody's home, and he wants to catch him alive, and then he ends up releasing him somewhere, you know, where there's no people, because he cares about the animals, even though the animals are dangerous. He doesn't want to kill them unless he has to. But in this case, you try to kind of take care of the animal, and the animal is trying to kill you as you're trying to save its life. That's what America has become. It doesn't deserve being hoped for anymore. It's like, you're on your own. Go to hell. Do your thing. You'll die. I just have to make sure how to not be too affected by your actions and the consequences of your decisions. And that's what we have to hope for. Not hope for America, hope for ourselves. We will be spared from what's coming somehow. The demise of this country that had so much promise and so much hope and was so loved, but threw all that love out and spat upon those who loved her. Thank you very much for listening.